Morning, Your Honors. Mike Catlett from the Osborne Maladon Law Firm in Phoenix, Arizona, on behalf of Petitioner Jaime Aldos Leonardo, Jr. The BIA abused its discretion in this case when it denied Petitioner's motion to reopen on grounds that it was both untimely and lacking in merit. Petitioner's counsel, who has since been suspended from the practice of law, prejudiced Petitioner when he failed to file any applications for relief and counseled Petitioner that post-conviction relief was Petitioner's only hope to avoid removal. Despite Petitioner's repeated phone calls and letters to Mr. Jordan, Petitioner did not definitively learn of Mr. Jordan's ineffective assistance of counsel until December 27, 2007. Now, before I address the merits of the equitable tolling and the ineffective assistance of counsel claims in this case, I'd like to quickly address the government's jurisdictional arguments. The government claims that this court lacks jurisdiction because the equitable tolling claim in this case is inherently factual, and because Mr. Leonardo has been accused of an aggravated felony. While the Real ID Act does strip this court of jurisdiction over appeals asking this court to revisit final orders of removal when the alien in question is alleged to have been convicted of an aggravated felony, 8 U.S.C. section 1252A2D specifically grants this court jurisdiction over constitutional claims and questions of law, regardless of the underlying offense. Logically, Petitioner's motion to reopen is comprised of two claims. First, it's an equitable tolling claim, and second, it's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. With regard to the first claim, the equitable tolling claim, this court held in Gaurimani, which was a case involving an alien who was alleged to have committed an aggravated felony, that although the equitable tolling analysis is a mixed question of law and fact, where the historical facts are undisputed, such that this court need only decide the legal significance of the historical facts, the equitable tolling analysis qualifies as a question of law over which this court possesses jurisdiction. Here, the BIA made no factual findings inconsistent with petitioner's asserted facts, and the government has not controverted petitioner's version of the facts. Thus, as was the case in Gaurimani, this court possesses jurisdiction over the equitable tolling claim.
On a motion to reopen, how could the government ever dispute the facts? I guess file an opposition?
Yes, Your Honor. They could file an opposition. They could request a hearing.
So there was no opposition filed?
None at all. The facts in this case with regard to when things were filed, the acts taken on behalf of petitioner by Mr. Jordan are undisputed. And so all this court has to do is look at those facts and apply the law. With regard to the ineffective assistance portion of petitioner's claim, the ineffective assistance claim alleges a violation of petitioner's due process rights. Thus, it's a constitutional claim within the meaning of the Real ID Act. And on top of that, this court in the Fernandez versus Gonzalez decision specifically held that the court possesses jurisdiction over aliens' claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. So turning to the merits of the petition, and specifically petitioner's equitable tolling claim, that claim is made up of three parts. First, there has to be some action or event that triggers equitable tolling. Then there has to be due diligence on the part of petitioner. And third, there's some event that ends equitable tolling, at which case the petitioner then has 90 days to file his motion to reopen. In this case, generally the action that triggers equitable tolling is deception, fraud, or error on the part of the petitioner's attorney. Here, like in this court's Iturribarria decision, the triggering event was Mr. Jordan's failure to file any applications on petitioner's behalf. But that's not all that Mr. Jordan did. He also erroneously informed petitioner that his only avenue for relief was through post-conviction proceedings and attempted to cover up his malfeasance by refusing to communicate with petitioner or provide him with a copy of his file. Now, the government argues that the failure to file necessary applications cannot be the triggering event because the triggering event must occur during the 90-day motion to reopen period. The government, however, cites no authority for that position, and it's likely because there is no such authority. The government's argument is also inconsistent with Gaurimani and Iturribarria, where, as here, this court found that equitable tolling was appropriate despite the fact that the triggering event, which in one case was the failure to prep a client for the hearing, and in the second case, like in this one, was failure to file necessary papers. Both of those occurred at or before the petitioner's removal proceedings and not during the 90-day period after appeal for filing a motion to reopen. Both cases make sense because essentially if this court were to accept the government's argument, petitioner could never make an ineffective assistance of counsel claim on a motion to reopen where the actions giving rise to the ineffective assistance claim occurred at or before the final merits hearing. Second, petitioner undoubtedly exercised due diligence in ascertaining the status of his case and investigating Mr. Jordan's conduct. The record reflects that between September 11, 2006 and December 4, 2007, petitioner called Mr. Jordan at least 40 times, and petitioner and his family wrote to Mr. Jordan at least 10 times to check on the status of his case and to attempt to obtain copies of his legal file. Petitioner even went so far as to write the California Bar to ask for assistance in a statement.
Remember from the government's brief, they zeroed in on that event.
The California Bar
event?
They
filed his complaint with the California Bar.
Yes, Your Honor. That is.
He must have known then.
Well, that is one of the proposed sort of end dates that that the government sets forth in its brief. However, the Bar complaint, if you look at it, it states only that Mr. K, in quoting the Bar complaint directly, it states that Mr. K. Jordan did not file any relief on my behalf at the immigration court. So this doesn't reflect that at the time that Leonardo filed his Bar complaint, that he had definitively learned of his claim against Mr. Jordan. It didn't. That was one of 20 things listed in the Bar complaint, and it doesn't indicate that at that point Mr. Leonardo had learned that Mr. Jordan's failure to file had actually prejudiced him. But it does show absolutely that he was concerned about Mr. Jordan's actions. But the record is clear that at the time of the Bar complaint, petitioner still didn't have a copy of his legal file, and he still had been unable to retain legal counsel.
Is it appropriate, assume you've covered Garamani and Iturribarria in terms of due diligence and prejudice and so forth, is it appropriate for the court to look beyond the ineffective assistance of counsel argument and look at the underlying merits and with any degree of skepticism about Mr. Leonardo's possible or plausible grounds for relief? I mean, he's got the issue of marriage and the fraud in the visa. He's got questions, still got question whether he can meet the In Re YL criteria.
Right. The question that this court has to address is whether Mr. Leonardo has some plausible ground for relief. So I don't think it's a case where the court it's appropriate for the court to decide whether Mr. Leonardo can definitively establish his claims. Now, plausibility, I think that's probably less than a 50% chance. But as I set forth in the brief, there even if you assume that that Mr. Leonardo was convicted of an aggravated felony, that's no bar to relief necessarily because he hasn't been in prison or sentenced to more than an aggregate of 5 years. Even if it's a trafficking crime, that still doesn't presumptively ban him from relief for withholding. And also, given that the government hasn't refuted any of Leonardo's the factual basis for his withholding and deferral claims.
How does the fraud allegation fit within those two avenues of relief?
Excuse me?
The fraud allegation. The marriage.
The fraud allegation is, and I'm no immigration expert, but as far as I can tell, the fraud allegation is also not a bar to withholding or deferral of removal under 1231 or CAT. Now, the government also proposes two other dates in its brief besides the VAR complaint date for when it thinks that the equitable tolling period stopped in this case. The first date was actually the date when Mr. Jordan stood up during the final merits hearing and said, I'm not filing any applications for relief. The government and the BIA said, well, Mr. Leonardo was present when that occurred. But this argument is also inconsistent with Garamani and Iturribarria. In both those cases, the petitioner was physically present when his lawyer took the actions that eventually were felt found to be ineffective. And the government said that in one case, the filing period didn't begin to run until over 3 years later, and in the other, it didn't begin to run. Actually, in both cases, it was nearly 3 years later, not the date on which the actions actually occurred. Second, the government argues that the filing deadline commenced on September 27, 2006, because petitioner stated in his motion to reopen that, quote, that was when he first had concrete reasons to know of Mr. Jordan's ineffectiveness, because that's the date that Mr. Jordan failed to file a petition for review with this court on his behalf. Now, again, petitioner certainly had reason to be concerned that Mr. Jordan was not doing his job at that time, but he still didn't know that, despite his prior convictions, he had plausible grounds for relief. In fact, after that date, long after that date, petitioner wrote to Mr. Jordan on several occasions that he still believed that post-conviction relief was his only chance to defeat removal, and he still wrote to Mr. Jordan asking about how Mr. Jordan's attempts to obtain post-conviction relief were going. The argument that September 27, 2006 is the appropriate date is also incorrect because equitable tolling period.
It's that date? I can't remember. What was the event on that date?
It's the date that Mr. Jordan originally failed to file a petition, the first petition for review challenging the BIA's affirmance of his original appeal. Mr. Leonardo was forced to file that brief pro se. So it's actually very similar to the Singh case, because which is relied upon by the government, because in that case the petitioner that admitted that he became suspicious that counsel was not doing his job a few weeks after entry of the final order of removal, when his family said, hey, your lawyer's not doing his job. He basically he admitted in his briefs that that was the correct date, but this court said that as a matter of law, the petitioner was incorrect, and that the filing period actually commenced 3.5 months later. That was the definitively learned date when Mr. Singh actually obtained a lawyer who confirmed that the petitioner's lawyer was ineffective. If there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve.
Board's decision, did it actually reach the ineffective assistance of counsel issue?
Yes, Your Honor. In the board's decision.
Where? Which part of the decision?
At the excerpts of record is at 99. It's the board's decision.
Got it.
In that decision, the board says, quote, under the circumstances, the respondent has not shown his constitutional right to due process was violated by his former counsel's conduct. It also said that the respondent's motion to reopen fails to establish that he is eligible for any relief from removal, and he has not shown what plausible grounds for relief his former counsel could have presented.
And that's ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. The first is, I think, it's addressing both the defective performance and the prejudice part of it. It's just saying generally we don't think that his right to due process was violated. And the second specifically addresses the prejudice prong when it says that there's no plausible grounds for relief here.
So what is it that you're asking for?
I would ask that that you grant the petition for review, that you vacate the order of removal, and that you remand to the BIA for a new hearing.
On the merits of the application. Or so that he can file an application, actually.
He can file his applications, and also, I think as our prior argument demonstrated, there's been a lot of the aggravated felony in this case is an 11378 claim, and as the prior argument demonstrated, there's been a lot of changes in the law in the, since 2006 when petitioner first had his merits hearing, so we would request a clean slate where he can make any arguments he needs to make that aren't prejudiced by counsel's failure.
How does he clean up his record, though? I mean, what is he going to argue when he gets if he gets another hearing before the BIA?
One thing he can argue is that his conviction isn't an aggravated felony, and other than that, he can present testimony that if he is sent back to the Philippines, he has a legitimate fear of persecution. And he faces a substantial likelihood of being tortured.
Is there anything in the record that we now have that would give any basis for this torture claim in the Philippines?
All you have is Mr. Leonardo's statements in his motion to reopen and in his briefs. And if you look at the case law, I think at this stage, the court has to assume that those assertions are true. And with that in mind, analyze whether there's some plausible ground for relief.
It looks like his really chance is deferral of removal under the cap, if he can make the showing.
Well, I think that he has a withholding claim possibility, too, based on the fact, I mean, he has an uphill battle because of the possibility that the 11378 is an aggravated felony. But if you look at the records in the administrative record, his conviction records, I think that there's some issues with that also. So if he can sort of argue around that, then I think that that he has at least plausible grounds for relief, and he has the right to present his case anew.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Morning. May it please the Court. My name is Drew Brinkman on behalf of the Attorney General. Your Honor, if Mr. Leonardo entered the United States using a fraudulently procured visa, he was convicted of numerous drug-related felonies, and he was found removable as an aggravated felon. During his removal hearing, he indicated that he wanted to apply for relief in the form of cancellation of removal. However, no application was ever filed, so the immigration judge denied his claims, and the board dismissed his appeal.
Why doesn't he have a constitutional right to effective counsel at this stage of the proceedings, at the stage we're talking about? Doesn't he have a Fifth Amendment right to effective to counsel? And
at this stage, at
the stage where he the BIA found against him and ordered his removal, Jordan's performance was abysmal, wasn't it?
Depending on how you view his pleadings, if you view them as wholly true, it could have been so. I mean, it appeared that there's no dispute about this aggravated felony. And if that aggravated felony, he did commit that aggravated felony, his removal as an aggravated felon, he had no venues of relief except for withholding of removal and cat protection, as you've talked about. Now, it doesn't appear that he ever brought up those claims to his attorney below. There's really no indication except later, a year and a half later.
Do you think an attorney has any obligation to investigate the claims?
The attorney, sure. The attorney, I mean, they should talk about what sort of claims you have. But if you look at, even if you look at the contract between Mr. Leonardo and his attorney, it says, I'm hiring you to seek cancellation of removal. That's in the record. It doesn't say anything about withholding of removal. It says, your representation is to seek cancellation of removal. So to me, it appears just to the speculation of whether this was ineffective assistance, and I don't think the board really made a finding on this, but he could have been doing his job completely right, and he could have been, the only way he thought that there could have been relief is if he got those convictions vacated.
Do you think Mr. Leonardo is so sophisticated that he knows the fine distinctions between cancellation and withholding of removal? Because I wouldn't want to have a bar exam than any bar exam I had to take.
I would have no idea as to Mr. Leonardo's what he knew about different forms of relief. But I would say during the removal hearing itself, the immigration judge laid out, look, I think you're ineligible for these, and these forms of relief because you're an aggravated felon. You're barred. Now, as to withholding removal and cat protection, you didn't file an application. He said that to him three different times. Mr. Leonardo was present during those times. And that happened on April 26, 2006. So Mr. Leonardo's there. He hears these things. I mean, I think if he has, you know, some sense, he should be able to comprehend what the immigration judge is saying at that point. I mean, it's his case. I would think he would have some understanding of what's going on. And the IJ says you're ineligible for these things because you're an aggravated felon, but you didn't file for relief as to withholding and CAT, so I'm denying your claim. He's on notice at that point that, you know, this guy might have screwed up. I need to do something about this.
So what was it that motivated Mr. Leonardo to persist so zealously thereafter to try to get information from his lawyer, ultimately filing a bar complaint, if, in fact, he heard and understood the judge to telling him why he didn't have any chance at all.
He might have believed that he thought his attorney screwed up. But his obligation at that point is to file a motion to reopen within 90 days. His obligation is not to continuously write letters to his attorney. It's fool me once, shame on you, fool me. I mean, his attorney could just keep rejecting those letters, and his reopening period is extending into infinity at that point. I mean, he should have known when the immigration judge said that his attorney had screwed up. His obligation is not to write his attorney. His obligation is to find a new attorney or to file a motion to reopen on his own behalf. That's the government's position. Congress set 90 days. That's what they have to file these motions. So that's time one that the government thinks this 90 days.
So even though he retained this lawyer, paid him $10,000, at least that's what we know in the paperwork,
to file for cancellation of removal, right, according to the same paper.
So at that hearing, when he didn't file anything, he should have said, okay, keep that, you know, you're fired, and I got to go find a new lawyer now and pay another $10,000 or whatever.
He should have filed a complaint against his lawyer immediately there, filed a motion to reopen within 90 days. Whether he wanted to get a new attorney represent himself was up to him. Mm-hmm. But that's what he should have done.
Was he in custody at the time?
He was.
If he filed the bar complaint within 90 days but didn't move to reopen, would there be equitable tolling in that circumstance?
No, the equitable tolling is the 90-day period is when the motion is filed. The board and Congress has given them 90 days to put together all this paperwork and to file this motion. It doesn't take that much. They write a pleading.
But that's why you've got a constitutional right to counsel, is that these laws are hardly models of clarity. You should see Mike's staff trying to give me a tutorial on immigration law. It's embarrassing at times.
But the constitutional right, in my view, the court doesn't need to ever reach whether there was a constitutional violation in this case, because there's procedural limits as to how he has to exercise that.
You basically, he's not entitled to equitable tolling.
Right.
That's your...
So that throws it out. We don't even need to get to the issue of whether there's a constitutional right at all. And there's, you know, there's all kinds of stuff. I don't know if the court's aware, but there's a lot of stuff going on between the Attorney General, new regulations coming out about ineffective assistance. The Attorney General's been back and forth as to where there is ineffective assistance. So that's a very hairy issue. It's not been briefed. But the due diligence equitable tolling issue is dispositive in this case. So going back, we have the time one.
So your position is that he should have known, he knew definitively under our case law, the standards that we have adopted for equitable tolling. He knew when... At the hearing, when the IJ asked his counsel, are you going to file any papers and applications, and he said no.
I don't see the standard in this court as being he definitively knew. That's a major disagreement between the two sides. It's when he should have known that his attorney was ineffectively assisted him. If the standard is that when he definitively knew, the standard is completely in his control. He could say right now, I still don't definitively know if he effectively assisted me. It's an objective standard, and the board is looking at this, looking at the motion to reopen, saying, well, when should someone have filed this?
Is it a reasonableness standard in terms of what an alien facing deportation in custody at the time should have known?
The fact that he was in custody doesn't have too much bearing on this, because he was present at the removal hearing. He got a copy of the board's decision, which is time two that we think he should have known. He says in his motion to reopen that he knew his attorney was ineffective in September of 2006. That's his own claim. And time four is when he filed a complaint against his attorney. That's when we think he should have known, when he's filing a complaint against his own attorney. Whether he was in custody or not during any of those dates, it doesn't really have any bearing.
Did the IJ give him that 90-day notice in writing? Did he know he had 90 days to get another lawyer or get something started? He spent a year dithering around with his lawyer and filing complaints with the bar and so on, but did he know about the 90 days?
I'd have to look. I don't remember seeing any notice of that sort in the record. I think he gets a notice of his appeal to the board, which he did then appeal. And then I don't know if the board then gives him a notice about reopening after that point. I haven't seen such a notice, and I don't think in any cases they ever receive that notice.
Well, what's your best case on the proposition that he has to have some colorable claim of a defense if he does get it reopened?
Well, if we get to that point, you're talking about whether
in other words, is there a
prima facie relief?
Such a thing as harmless error.
Right.
If you have a lawyer that is egregiously incompetent, as this apparently was, but if you have no defense, suppose he had Johnny Cochran backed up by Ted Olson, what kind of a case would he bring on reopening?
It would be, I think counsel laid it out correctly. It would be, I think they could probably re-adjudicate whether he was an aggravated felon. But assuming he is an aggravated felon, it would only be withholding of removal.
Well, once it's established that he's an aggravated felon, what else is there?
Withholding of removal and cat protection.
Yeah, but we don't have any jurisdiction then, do we?
Jurisdiction over withholding and cat?
Yeah. If he's found to be an aggravated felon under the federal statute, that's the end of the story, isn't it?
You're saying if the case went back down, he was again found and then brought back up?
I just wonder why it wouldn't be a fool's errand to send this back to have him go through the whole history of his activities.
Wouldn't he have the right to request deferral at a minimum?
He'd have the right to a hearing. And
we had a case yesterday.
I hate to throw away an argument that you're giving someone, but I think he does have the right.
Right. We had a case yesterday, a fellow from Iran who had all kinds of convictions and whatnot, and the government granted him, the IJ granted him deferral of removal under CAT.
Mm-hmm. And he could be eligible for that. He very well could not be. I mean, I view all of his motion to reopen statements with a high degree of skepticism because he's totally changed his story. There's a point where he was talking to the DHS agent when he was initially found in jail after he was arrested, and he says, I have no fear of persecution upon going back to it. And so that just leads me to believe he's trying to delay these proceedings, and that's really all this is. He's just changed his story. So,
is he still in custody today, by the way?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah. So I want to briefly touch upon the two other major points where I think this court could say, look, he knew that his attorney was gave ineffective assistance as of these dates, and he didn't file within 90 days. The one is the one he claimed in his motion to reopen. He said he knew when his attorney didn't file a petition for review that he was ineffective assistance. He didn't file within 30 days of that. Now, that's his own claim, and he didn't file within 90 days of that. And the other time is when he filed a complaint against his attorney. Presumably, when you file a complaint with the state bar against your attorney, you know or you should have known there was ineffective assistance in that instance. And he didn't file his motion to reopen within 90 days of even that. So giving him the benefit of the doubt over and over and over again, he still didn't file within 90 days of any of these dates where he should have known that his attorney had ineffectively assisted him. The board is the first judge of when Mr. Leonardo should have known that his attorney ineffectively assisted him. This court reviews the board's decision under the highly deferential abuse of discretion standard. And given the evidence that he should have known at all these dates, the board didn't abuse his discretion, and this court should deny the petition for review. And if there's no further questions, I'll sit down.
I do have one. Let me ask you one question.
Sure.
If we disagree with you on the equitable tolling, did the board address ineffective assistance of counsel?
There is that sentence in there, and I don't really know what the board was, why they were saying that. I don't think it was a true finding because the board didn't need to reach that issue because there's the equitable tolling that was dispositive. The board didn't cite any. I mean, usually if the board makes that finding, it cites Lozada or it would cite a case from this court talking about ineffective assistance and due process. There's no citation at all. So I don't think the board reached that issue. I mean,
that's obviously the way you read the order because you didn't even address it in your red brief. You didn't address ineffective assistance of counsel?
No, because we thought due diligence was dispositive before you reached that point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very quickly, Judge Jordan, Judge Layton, you're perfectly correct that Jordan's performance in this case was abysmal, and the immigration judge specifically comments on that in his decision. Mr. Leonardo likely didn't bring up withholding and CAT claims to Mr. Jordan because Mr. Jordan had informed him we don't know if he informed him of this, but Mr. Jordan was operating under the erroneous conclusion that Mr. Leonardo's alleged aggravated felony made him ineligible for relief whatsoever. And so, as a non-lawyer, I don't think we can expect Mr. Leonardo to understand that he did, in fact, have plausible grounds for relief when his lawyer's telling him he didn't. And just quickly, I'd like to quote the applicable standard from the Garamani case. It says the limitations period is told until the petitioner definitively learns of counsel's defectiveness and cites to the Singh versus Gonzalez case. Thank you, Your Honors. Okay.
Thank you. That case, Leonardo versus Holder, is submitted. And that ends our session for today. Thank you all very much.